The OTB Brief. Everything you need to know about sport every morning. Need to get on top of the day's sports news? Well, the OTB Brief is the only sports update you'll need every morning. With all the breaking stories, post-match reaction.
They had one more day to rest. We were really in trouble. Really in trouble to build the team.
And the best bits from off the ball, all in a 10-minute podcast.
Oh, sweaty palms. Of course, you guys know what it's like, but that was nervy.
The OTB Brief, online every morning from 7 a.m. on offtheball.com, the Go Loud app, and everywhere you get your podcasts. The OTB Podcast Network.
Oh, the shape that will get if you let all the fans down.
Can we not lock it?
It's a fact. I'm not playing mind games. I'm talking about facts.
I always said if I was Aladici, I would probably say I was more of a tactical genius.
The answer questions on anything. Religious, politics, health, you know, sexual problems.
Look at his face! Just look at his face!
None of you, except for those two, have done anything to justify the money that you earn. None of you! Disgrace!
And I suggest you shut up and show more football.
And you're very welcome along to this week's Team 33. Enda Coll here with you for the next hour or so. Coming up on tonight's show, we are back reviewing our movies, and Green Street is the movie of choice this week. We'll also speak to Connor Clancy, live from Italy. He was on a couple of weeks ago, or a couple of months ago, before Serie A came back. His hair was slightly longer, his beard was slightly longer, and he hadn't been out of the house in about 6 or 7 days. Thankfully, Italy are back to some sort of normality. The Serie A is back, and he's back going to games. So he's coming up a little bit later on in the show. But Will O'Callaghan joins me on the line because we are talking about Green Street Hooligans, if you're in the US. The film that was released in 2005, focusing on the GSE, West Ham's football firm. It's one of many football firm movies. Football violence doesn't depict football in a great way, but Will, it's an interesting film nonetheless.
Yeah, good evening. And it's a football film that features football, I think, for about 4, maybe 5 minutes during the film. We never actually get the big Millwall against West Ham showdown, which we're expecting in the end. That's almost like a sideshow, just to set up the final fight between the two firms. It's very clear that this is a movie that wasn't made by football fans. This was a movie made by a German filmmaker, Levi Alexander, who wrote the story, a German woman. And she felt that there were redeeming factors to be found in the idea of the firms and the idea of being, I guess, faithful to the people around you. And that's the message here. It's not just that your friends will have your back, but there's almost something in having the back of your friends. And that's kind of the abiding message. And that's what Elijah Wood's character is meant to learn. And we have Frodo goes to football. That's ultimately what Green Street is. The one thing I would say in a positive sense, because we are going to bash the hell out of this movie, I would imagine, over the next 20 minutes or so, is that I rewatched it this morning. It's an hour and 42 minutes long. And those hour and 42 minutes actually fly by. It's actually still an enjoyable enough watch. You will be cringing and probably laughing at most of it, but it is pretty easy. It flies by, Enda.
Yeah, well, this is a film that I've watched countless times, almost an embarrassingly amount of times, because it was just something me and my brother would sit down and watch on a Saturday evening if there was nothing else to do. It did come out in 2005, and like you said, Frodo Baggins goes to a football match. This was Elijah Wood's third film after the Lord of the Rings franchise. It was a weird of sort of a backstep more than a forward step in his acting career.
Yeah, you'd have to wonder what his agent was thinking. Maybe he felt that he was getting involved in this kind of gritty project and that he was going to go over to the UK and shoot this. And I'm sure he had to be very aware coming out of Lord of the Rings, and you got to be thinking, I don't want to be typecast. Like, I'm now Frodo Baggins in everybody's mind. And even when he did Sin City, he tried to kind of move away from that. He played a bad guy in Sin City who was also a mute, and it was a very different type of character to Frodo Baggins. I think he was trying to just, you know, basically change his career around a bit. Like, Elijah Wood, when you think about it, will always be remembered for Lord of the Rings. And subsequently, he hasn't done a huge amount of huge projects after that. And I think this was probably an attempt on his part where I'm sure when he looked at this screenplay, it looked a little bit gritty, a little bit interesting, and then you kind of see the clangor it turned out to be when it was eventually filmed and put up on screen. And I actually think a large part of it isn't down to Elijah Wood. Elijah Wood is probably one of the best parts about the movie in terms of just a purely acting point of view. The acting issue is probably far more with a guy who goes on to have a lot of fame with Sons of Anarchy later on, and that's Charlie Hunnam, who definitely puts on the worst Essexy London accent you will ever hear. Like, his Mockney Cockney is just so awful. this is up there definitely with like Sean Connery trying to do an accent that's not Scottish. It's just awful.
Yeah, and I suppose focusing on Elijah Wood for the time being, a lot of actors struggle with that sort of typecasting when they've been in such a famous franchise. If you look at the likes of Daniel Radcliffe, he took a weird left step after the Harry Potter franchise when he went into some sort of like horror, and now he's working on stage plays in London. So how difficult is it for those characters to get away from that? Because even if you look at some of the more comedy side of acting, the likes of Steve Carell will always be Michael from The Office. So Elijah Wood doesn't do a bad job in this movie. Like he, for a second or two, you do forget that he was Frodo.
Yeah, look, I mean, it's a perfectly serviceable performance. You think around that kind of just after Lord of the Rings period, he's in Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, where he plays the ever so slightly creepy love interest for Kate Winslet's character, where he's using her own information against her in an attempt to get with her, which is going away from type. And here he's trying to play an American that I suppose we're meant to sympathize with because he gets screwed over in the early stages of the movie by his housemate, who's an absolute asshole. And he's that kind of preppy Harvard guy who eventually dumps the fact that he had cocaine in their dorm room onto Elijah Wood's character, Matt. And then Matt ends up having to leave college. He's almost too embarrassed about it to tell his family. Doesn't tell his dad, who's a journalist at the Times in England, but seems to kind of jet set around the Middle East to cover stories. A far more glamorous journalist than most of us know. And his sister has married into a family in London. So he gets onto a flight to Boston, goes across to London, and this is how it's set up for him to be a character that we're meant to care about. I'm not sure how sympathetic it really is, this idea of him leaving college and deciding not to actually appeal against the decision because he's afraid of the influence that his prep boy friend who he was staying with in the dorm room is actually meant to be. But this is what we get. Elijah Wood's character goes across to the UK, turns up into London, and realistically, I think within a day, maybe less, I think it's the night that he arrives, he ends up going to a football game at West Ham in the Championship and ends up getting involved with the firm. It all kind of moves along very quickly.
Yeah, I think the first scene where he arrives in London, I think it's the following day after he gets a good night's sleep that he goes out to a game, but before he arrives in London, you see a fight between the West Ham fans and the Spurs fans in the tube in London, and the city's sort of in a mess when he arrives. There's phone boxes smashed, glass all over the ground, and he asks his sister, what was there, a terrorist attack in the city centre? And she turns around, no, it was Sunday football madness. It's just it's such an Americanized version of this word that they're trying to depicture it away.
Yeah, it's kind of funny as well, Enda, because you've got this situation where it's normalized as if this violence happens on every single weekend and as if there's a London derby every week and one of the London teams has gone to the other side of the city and therefore there was just gang violence and the police just come in and sweep up afterwards. And like, surveillance is one of those things that's kind of a hugely heavy theme, because we get these shots where they go back out to the security footage of what's happening within the fights, and yet it seems to take the police an absolute eternity to turn up to any of them, particularly that scrap that we'll probably talk about in Manchester between the United fans and the West Ham fans. Like, there's surveillance everywhere. It's outside of a train station. You would imagine that there would be security at the train station, and yet it seems to take an absolute eternity for the police to arrive. It's almost like, from the writing point of view, there's this acceptance that this kind of violence just happens on a regular basis and that it's a way of actually sorting out arguments legitimately. And it's heavily romanticized as well. Like, usually when it comes to these movies, even if you look at, you know, say Football Factory, which is, you know, a little bit more gritty even than this, there is that kind of feeling that it's all for nothing and that at least there's a moral lesson to be learned, that, you know, these men are going out and wasting their time and should be looking for something else to do. There's actually a feeling, I think, in Green Street that there's moral lessons to be taken from fighting and that it's actually a good thing, which I think is a very strange message. It's not one that you're going to see in many of these hooligan movies.
Yeah, and that was a purposely done thing by the director, who I watched how this film was made a few years ago, and she was basically saying that she wanted to show that these are normal people. So you see the likes of Pete Dunham getting off his seat and letting a pregnant woman sit down on the tube, and then he's a school teacher, and they all go about normal lives. One of them is I think he's a pilot, or he works for the airport.
Yeah.
And they normalize these people, and she wanted that was done purposely so that you could see that there are other sides to these people and that they're softer people inside. But again, like you said, they don't really condemn the violent side of these people.
No, and like some of these characters that we meet during the story, you mentioned the fact that, you know, their mate who basically gives them the tip off, I think his name is David, in Manchester, is a pilot. He seems very successful and he's in his pilot's uniform when the rest of the firm arrive for the game. You've got Steve, who, you know, we'll eventually talk about, you know, who turns out to be the guy that was basically the founder of the firm that they're in. And he seems to be a very successful businessman. He's got this, you know, very attractive American wife. He's got his kids. He's got his kids set up and seems to live in quite a nice area. And then you've got these working class guys who are kind of the foot soldiers effectively within the Green Street elite. It's kind of strange. It's almost like they made a very conscious decision to say, right, these are people who live normal lives. And even Pete, it turns out, is a PE and history teacher within the school. It's like, it's kind of unusual the way they do it, because Pete, when we first meet him, is trying to borrow 100 quid to go to the pub. And yet it turns out he has a full-time teaching gig and probably has a reasonable amount of money. There's definitely that kind of conflict between, usually we're talking about like young working class men, and that's definitely how they seem at the very start. And then very quickly you see there's actually people in quite respectable jobs who are taking part in this firm. Whether that's realistic to life, I'm not quite sure.
Yeah, so let's talk about Pete. Pete Dunham, he's the up-and-coming head officer, if you want to say, from in the GSE, the Green Street Elite, the West Ham football firm. He's Steve Dunham's brother, who used to be the major of the firm, the founder of the firm, essentially. We first meet him in the opening scene where, like you said, he's coming to borrow money. He's this cocky, arrogant, bravado Englishman from London with a terrible London Cockney accent. Charlie Hunnam, this is an early day Charlie Hunnam. It's before Sons of Anarchy, it's before The Gentleman. He's really taken off in the last couple of years, but this is sort of early days, and this is not one of his best roles.
No, it's a strange piece of casting. I mean, obviously they've decided to pick Charlie Hunnam because of his looks at this point. You know, there's quite a few torso shots. There's those unnecessary walking through the apartment while putting on the top shots that happen later on in the movie. And he's there to be a sympathetic character. You know, at the end, you've got Elijah Wood's character saying, this is the guy I want to emulate. You know, I want to live the rest of my life in almost like in the way that Pete lived his. He's taken over from his brother as the head of the firm. You know, we kind of get the tell not show moments where it's like, oh, he was involved in this legendary dust up that happened in Manchester, and he was involved in the original Millwall one where we're going to see the revenge for it later on in the movie. And you know, Pete, for the best part, is he seems to be liked by pretty much everybody within the firm, and he decides at a fairly early stage, it's like we get this kind of strange moment where we've this mini almost half fight between Matt and Pete early on, and it's almost the fact that Pete doesn't get a no from Matt about going to the game. That means that within moments he's like, right, you're coming to the match, come on, you're going to become part of my firm. And then he obviously leads things in a fairly kind of passive way. He has an awareness of, somewhat of an awareness about Matt's background and the fact that, you know, his dad was a journalist. I'm sure he had to have suspicions, you know, considering that the two things they really hate are the police, other firms, and journalists. And they say that frequently. It's like, oh, journals are worst of the worst. And it's like he obviously then decides to protect Elijah Wood's character throughout the rest of the movie, despite the fact that he's warned on numerous occasions throughout that there could be potentially issues there. And it puts him, look, in direct conflict with Bover as well, who will eventually effectively betray, like the Judas character, who then redeems himself afterwards within the gang, is that almost his relationship between Matt and Pete is what puts Pete into trouble throughout the entire film.
Yeah. What do we make of the general flow of the movie? Because there are several key scenes, like the fight scenes and then the different reveals where Bover double crosses the GSE, etc., and stuff like that. But the general feel of the film, I thought, was actually quite good. Like if you look at the opening scene where they go to the Abbey, the pub where they go to before the game, and just the shite that they're talking in it before a football match with a few pints, it does encapsulate the sort of match day feel or the match day preparation that people who frequent football matches in England would go through.
Yeah, and like I actually probably my favorite scene I think in the entire film is in the first third, where we get West Ham going on to take on Birmingham, and very clearly you've got the Birmingham fans who they're obviously familiar with these West Ham guys already, and you've got the Green Street crew who are pretty much in the first two rows watching the game, and then Bover manages to get himself a steward's outfit. I think he's got a media bib on, and he's able to make his way over to the Birmingham crowd, and he's able to wind them up. Which results in that kind of first action scene after that. Like, I really enjoyed the way that the football was presented. I thought it was presented really slickly, the West Ham against Birmingham footage. And then the Birmingham fans decide to try and jump Elijah Wood's character as he's leaving, because it's very clear, even at this early stage, that there's tensions between the gang about having an American involved with them. He decides to leave, but it turns out that the Green Street guys have his back. And we get this kind of fairly interesting, very stylized violent scene, where there seems to be as well, with the exception of the final stages, Enda, if you think about it, there's very few repercussions for what actually happens. Like, nobody gets that badly injured. People take some serious smacks in these fights where probably teeth should be out of their mouth, where you'd imagine the jaws get dislocated, but yet everyone seems to brush it off. They feel a little bit rough, two anodynes the next morning, and they're right back ready to fight again.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that somebody gets hit with a brick in that scene as well, and glassed in the face. So it's an odd one. The violence is a weird one in this, because there's a major plot hole in the fact that how the hell did they know where Matt was going to be at that point in time if he were to get jumped by a Birmingham crew?
Unless they followed him, but I don't think they did. Like, there was no implication that actually, go on, Matt, head down there and make sure you don't go to the train station at East Ham, but, you know, make sure you're all right. Like, unless they followed him, how did they get there quickly enough to prevent him getting that Chelsea smile, which the Birmingham guys were about to give him with the credit card? Like, I don't understand how they got in the scene that quickly.
No, and then the following, like, later on in the fight, where the other crew turn up at the fight to save the five or six men that followed Matt, it's a major plot hole in the film that really annoyed me, but I suppose this type of film, there's always going to be plot holes. So as we go on the movie, then essentially what happens is that Matt, he's won the approval after that one fight of most of the crew except for Bover, who's the right hand man. They don't trust him. He wins their approval by coming up with a plan. They're on their way to Manchester United, and the Man United fans are waiting for them outside the train station. They stop the train. He comes up with a plan that they get into the back of a van and flank the Manchester United fans, which, it was pretty good. It's a pretty novel scene, which was a nice addition to the film. So that wins Bover over slightly. But then Millwall come to town and he starts getting angsty.
Yeah, and like that scene in Manchester is really entertaining, because again, the West Ham crew, like, it's obviously funny the way that Bover hits the emergency sign and they get out in Macclesfield, and then they have to, you know, commandeer away to Manchester, and eventually it's Matt's character who has the pretty good idea to put them in the back of the van. He'll hide in the front and he pretends that they're filming a movie which has, I think they said it was Hugh Grant and Cameron Diaz, and the guys seem impressed that Cameron Diaz might be in town, and that was enough to cause the distraction for them to disperse and allow them to drive about 5 yards past the crew, stop, and then the Manchester guys don't seem to watch the van. They don't turn around until the point that the West Ham crew have actually picked up some road signs and some other weapons that they can use in the fight. And even at that, like, the West Ham crew are massively outnumbered. I think we're talking about like maybe 7 or 8 of them up against 50 or 60 guys.
Yeah.
And the Green Street crew seem to handle themselves reasonably well. I know they get the jump in the fight, but still, I don't know how they don't get overwhelmed. But yeah, that seems to be the point that Matt really gets into the crew. It's the point where Matt seems to actually enjoy the fighting, because obviously in the first row with the Birmingham guys, he's defending himself and he's in this desperate situation where he's trying to get out of there and he's scared and the guys come in to help him. In the Manchester one, he seems to really enjoy the violence, and for a guy who doesn't like look like he'd be able to, you know, fight his way out of a wet paper bag in the early exchanges in the movie, next thing Frodo is throwing punches all over the place and knocking people out. Like, it's amazing how a guy who they very clearly jokingly portrayed him as the karate kid in the pub at the start actually becomes quite useful with his hands with little or no training. It's an amazing transformation that happens in those few days between the two matches.
Yeah, and after that fight, I think I can't remember the exact wording, but he essentially talks about how it's not about you having your friends back, it's about them having your back as well. And that's sort of the general overriding theme throughout this entire film. Just moving on to the bad guys, Jeff Bell, Tommy Hatcher, the leader of the NTO, the Millwall firm. I think we've covered five films in this series, and for them, he has been the bad guy. So he plays that character quite well, and to be fair, he is probably one of the best things about this film because he is properly gritty.
He is, and like he's Whacker Harris in the film with Mike Bassett, England manager too. Yeah. So that always jumps my mind whenever I see him, is a slightly younger version playing the slightly psycho England centre half. So he's, as you mentioned, he pops up frequently in these football movies. I'm guessing obviously his agent probably just passes on the DVD of whatever previous one he's been in, and that helps him get cast. But like, he's perfectly cast here. It also kind of reminded me, in all of these movies, Millwall always seem to be the bad guys. Like in Football Factory, well, it's Chelsea against Millwall. In this one, it's West Ham against Millwall.
Are they wrong though?
Yeah, look, I suppose it probably plays into Millwall's reputation. I'm sure Millwall fans probably take it as a badge of appreciation, the fact that they're always cast in this way. But they're almost like the Nazis of movies in the 60s and 70s. They're always the bad guys when it comes to football. And we get that wonderfully kind of tense scene, you know, where Bobber decides to go across the city. He finds himself on his motorbike going to a small cafe. He's having his various stereotypical jelly deals and mushy peas at the table. And then we kind of get this moment where the Millwall crew come in, and there is that like incredible sense of dread, and also that most of the people who are in the cafe are fairly familiar that this is a guy not to mess with, so they shut up pretty much at the point that he begins to talk. And unfortunately, one woman who's at a table near to them, despite her boyfriend saying please be quiet or this is going to go badly, she says, hey, I'm not going to shut up for some guy who seems to be trying to threaten us. And unfortunately, her boyfriend gets his face caved in on the table as a result. So we kind of learn very early on that it's like, here's a guy who has a tragic story because of what's happened to his son and has every reason to be angry with the Green Street crew. But at the same time, he's slightly a psycho and he could go off at any point. And when he gets violent, he's unlikely to stop. So it's actually, that's a pretty clever piece of story writing, that I think within one scene, we get a character down. And despite the slight nuances that might be there, we straight away know this is a guy not to mess with within about 3 minutes on screen.
Yeah, and for some reason, Bobber decides to double cross the GSE. It's still not really confirmed in my head why he did it. It's slightly out of jealousy of Matt becoming best friends with Pete and rising to the top of the firm so quickly as an outsider, as a Yank. And it still doesn't really make sense to me, but essentially what he does is he goes over to Millwall and he tells Tommy Hatcher that Steve Dunham is in the Abbey again, because essentially what happens is Steve went down to save Pete because the crew had just found out that he was a journalism major. So that's a key point in this movie. That's a key turning point. That's something that would not be allowed in the firm, as a journalism major, in case he was an undercover journo, as they think he is. So Bobber tells Tommy Hatcher that he's in the pub, and they rush over and throw Molotov in the
cocktails,
cocktails into the pub, and they go in and stab Steve in the neck, which leads to him almost dying. This is all in the build up to Millwall playing West Ham in the FA Cup and before this big fight. That's one of the most dramatic scenes in the film, and it's probably brings together how deep this rivalry goes.
Yeah, like, we'll deal with probably maybe the kind of logical worries and concerns that I would have at this point about everything that happens in that kind of 5 minute period in the movie. So we get to a point where essentially Bobber comes across and gives the information, right? And he says, I can tell you that Steve is going to be at this pub at this time and you should attack. Now, the impression that I get is that the major, since he's retired from the firm, has actually climbed the corporate ladder, and all impressions seem to be that he's a very successful businessman, and he just comes back into the house and he's got a couple of £100 in cash, which he can just flip off at the start. He seems to live in a really nice spot and he's in good suits all the way throughout the movie. So the impression seems to be that since he's left the firm, he's done very well for himself. Okay. why not just go to Company House and find out what company he works for, go to his place of work, wait for him and get him there? It's like, it's not as if this guy has been traveling around Southeast Asia and hiding from the Millwall firm for the last 20 years. He's been living and working in London in what appears to be a quite prominent position. So this idea that, like, oh my God, we found out that he's in that pub where the rest of his firm very clearly drink and drink continually, shouldn't really feel like that much of a revelation, but it seems to work.
Yeah, the Millwall guys, the idea that might be because Tommy Hatcher presumes he's back in the firm.
Yeah, maybe. And maybe because he's back in the firm, he then becomes like okay to do a hit on. Like, as in, if he's not in the gang, we can't actually come after him. Despite the fact that, like, the major had very little to do with the death of the son, when we see the flashback, it's actually the other guys in the firm as opposed to him. And he has the most horrible mullet during that.
Oh, it's
probably
awful.
The best thing, probably the best thing that's happened in the 20 years, aside from his business work, is the haircut that he managed to get. But yeah, look, maybe you're right. Maybe it's the fact that he's back in with the firm, so we can turn this into firm on firm violence, as opposed to taking a guy out. But still, at the end of the film, Tommy has no problem with chasing down a car with the major's wife and kid and murdering the child in the back of a Range Rover. So I'm not sure they necessarily have some kind of moral system where he has to be killed within a fight. But yeah, I mean, we get that pretty dramatic scene within the bar where, you know, the Green Street crew are not prepared because they're already in fighting between themselves at the point that the rival gang arrive. And maybe that's why they're blindsided when it happens. They're more concerned about Matt and his journalistic background and the fact he's a journo, and now they have to do something about it. And then they end up having to go back into a major fight. And then that sets up this kind of final row that Millwall are due to play West Ham for the first time in 10 years. That turns out to be a complete MacGuffin. Like, we're kind of expecting that we're going to get to see maybe the match and the guys, you know, might have to fight on the way to the game or after the game or something like that. But instead, it just turns out that one of the guys in the Green Street crew has a mate who seems to operate somewhere right beside the Millennium Dome, yeah, which means you can put the Millennium Dome in the background. Like, I love, it's almost, this movie almost feels like, because it was a kind of a joint American an Anglo project, it's almost like something made by Americans who felt, what do Americans know about London that we can actually use here? So as opposed to going to, say, somewhere in South London or, you know, in East London, with the exception of going to Upton Park, it's like, even when Bover falls asleep, remember when he has that kind of moment of conscience,
it's beside the London Bridge.
He's on the, he's like basically on a bench on the London Bridge with everything in the background. And you may as well have, like, put him up in front of Big Ben. And then obviously for the fight itself, they managed to get the Millennium Dome into the background. So it's very clear. It's like, let's just keep on reinforcing to the Americans that they're in the middle of London. And then obviously the final scrap is able to happen there. Like, it's remarkably handy to have a mate who can arrange an area where the police are definitely not going to see you and where there's no cameras, because that's a running theme throughout, is that they can't get away with things because this is the most surveillance TV in the world is in London. But yes, they managed to find a building site which is entirely empty for them to have a big scrap.
Listen, Will, they also managed to burn down an entire pub and stab a fella in the neck without the police so much as turning up. So I reckon they were all right doing this in public, never mind trying to get a place out in private. I do really like the final scene, though. I have to say, I like the build up to it. The music's great. Matt walking down the street and deciding he's going to do it. I think the build up to it's brilliant. It's really gritty. The fighting is, like, the fight scenes are actually pretty good, despite the fact that several people should have died. But it ends with a really dramatic scene, and the sound of it still will always haunt me. The sound of Tommy Hatcher beating the numb face off Pete Dunham, because he's dead already. He's broken his neck with a headbutt. And it's as dramatic a finale as you'll get from one of these movies. Sometimes you get a happy ending with these, but this is just, there's no happy ending in it.
No, and to be honest, the first time I saw this, I think I saw this in the cinema, actually, back when it came out, was that I was so shocked with what happened. Because you're kind of thinking, if anyone's getting out of this fight, it's surely going to be the two characters who we have spent the last 90 minutes with, that surely Matt and Pete are going to survive, no matter what else happens. Maybe some of the henchmen or the right-hand men, or maybe Bover might end up having to give his life as a chance to actually redeem himself. But instead, we lose the main character within the movie in the most horrific terrific way possible. Okay, he gets to go out by giving a sacrifice, because in many ways he probably buys time for Matt, his sister, and the child to get out, because again, I really don't understand why she was on the way to the airport and on her way to Boston, and she decided to drive to this fight, and how she even knew where the fight was happening. But she turns up, puts herself in the middle of danger. The main Millwall henchman manages to stop the Range Rover from getting away. Bovver has to come over to try and get the save initially. And then when it's very clear that the bad guys, if we want to call them that, are about to descend on the Range Rover, he has to do something to try and distract Tommy. And it's basically, come and finish me off. And at that point, he's already in a pretty bad way. Like, he's already, I think he's got a stab just below his ribs. He's really struggling to walk. And you know that he's not going to be able to defend himself. But still, I thought something was going to come in and break it up. I didn't think Pete was going to end up being beaten to death. And that's the thing, when he hits the ground, you hear this horrible crunch, and then effectively he's indefensible, he's on the ground, and you just hear multiple, probably five or six very heavy smacks hit him in the face. Yeah. And we've got him dead. And at that point, the firms just seem to stop fighting. Like, it's kind of a really, really strange moment, but one I did not see coming at all.
Well, I don't think anybody's seen it coming, but what's more annoying is, like we touched on earlier on, the point of this should be that there is no good side to this violence. There's no way to justify it. These people are normal people that are driven by violence. They should have ended the movie there. They shouldn't have.
Yeah.
So that should have been the moral of the story, that this guy was a school teacher who was caught up in something bigger than him, and that he gave his life for it. But the ending then turns out to be Matt going back to Boston and facing up to his troubles and using his now hard man persona, having gone through all of this, he's able to finally stand up to the guy in Harvard. That was a really stupid ending, or a stupid decision from the director, in my opinion.
Yeah, it's horrifically corny. Like, what you need there is you need a studio or an editor probably to stand up to the director, who is also the screenwriter, because you have to go, right, the final scene really should be maybe even fade to black at the point when we realize that Pete is there face up, dead on the ground, and everyone who's fighting has actually stopped. Like, that could be the moral story. It's like, we've gone too far here. Like, I know there's a child that's been killed previously, but this is this kind of really horrific moment, and we get to see Tommy go absolute animal when he's killing him. It's almost like it should be a realization for both firms that it's like, okay, we enjoy a dust up and a scrap, but Jesus, we've gone too far here. That would have actually been a fairly impactful ending. It's the fact that, yeah, we go, then we arrive back in Boston, and he meets his former roommate who's doing cocaine in the toilet, so obviously he hasn't learned from his previous errors. And then, you know, cleverly, he's using his journalistic training, or the 5 out of 6 credits he may have picked up at Harvard, to covertly tape somebody, and says that he's going to use this with the Harvard board if needed to get back in. And we're meant to kind of celebrate that idea that, you know, he's going to go back and actually finish his degree. Which brings us back to that first point. It's like, am I meant to care that Matt got kicked out of college? Am I meant to care that he's going to go back to college? Do I feel that he's really gone on a journey and learned an interesting life message in terms of his arc? I don't know if he really has. And then he comes out of what was a restaurant, I think it was, and he's singing Blowing Bubbles and kind of celebrating everything that happened with the firm. It's really weird, because you got to remember too that Matt, and this is a very short movie, but Matt has only been to one football match with the firm.
Yeah.
Matt has only sang this song once, and now it appears to have a profound effect on his life. It's weird. We don't spend enough time actually with the crew at games. That's one thing, if you could go back and remake this movie, and thank God we don't have to review the sequel to this, but if you did go back and remake it, that's one thing I would definitely do. I would have had them going to more football games and built up kind of that relationship outside of the fighting, and let Millwall be this big fight, let Spurs at the start be this big fight, but have it that the relationship actually grows. Like, there's no way that Elijah Wood's week or whatever he had in England is going to have that profound an effect that now he's going to sit down and watch West Ham, and all the life lessons he learned are going to make him some kind of badass in America.
Yeah, it's just such a bizarre ending, and like you said, the relationship he's built up. How long do you reckon has passed since his friend died? I mean, 2 weeks, 3 weeks? When did he go back to Harvard? It's probably about
that long. Like, I mean, he can't have been in England all that long, because the impression they give is genuinely a couple of days, goes to the Birmingham game, definitely has a night on the couch, has a couple of days where he meets up with Pete, and they have that very funny scene where the 9-year-old children are knocking goals past
him. That's my favourite scene.
It's just so, like, so funny.
What are they, Olympic hopefuls? No, they're just regular boys. It's like, that's another one. It's like, damn, these English people really like football.
And also, I kind of wonder, like, as you said, you saw the behind the scenes on this. Did West Ham have some kind of involvement on an official level? Because obviously they've got the West Ham footage and they allowed them to shoot within Upton Park. And I'm guessing they must have been allowed to set up extra cameras for the really cool footage that they got of the game. And then the kids in that PE class are wearing full home and away West Ham kits. Like, I assumed when they were reaching into the bag, one team are going to wear bibs and one team are going to wear their regular gear. Oh, no, they're in tight player fit West Ham jerseys.
I think it's more a Reebok deal than a West Ham deal. I can't say for certain, but I'm nearly sure I read something about that because Reebok were the sponsors of West Ham at that point, so it's sort of tied in with that. So you touched on that. Let's talk about some of the best scenes in this before we wrap up. So you have the football match between the kids, which is brilliant. I love the deep dive into the Cockney rhyme and slang, or not so much a deep dive as the 5-minute rehearsal before we go into the pub. It's silly, it's stupid, it's not really accurate, but it just adds to the sort of air of this movie.
It does. And like, I did a very quick search while you were thinking there for where Charlie Hunnam is from. I had a feeling he was probably from the north of England as opposed to being from London. He's from Newcastle, so that probably makes a lot of sense. And I think even at the point when you went to make this movie, I think he'd already gone to America at that point. Like, he'd been in Queer as Folk, and I think he was in an American series called Undeclared before this happened. So he was living in the States, and there's an American twang even from time to time within his Cockney, which I think is probably just that he's been learning a more neutral American accent along the way. And then you hear the Cockney rhyming scheme. It's just absolutely hilarious. And it's like, as you say, it's literally a 30-second, here's all you need to know. And I think Elijah Wood managed to use one or two of those phrases within the conversation in some kind of attempt to keep it going.
Beans and then honey for money.
That's it, yeah. Give me some bees and honey. Like, it's just... Again, it's hilarious. This is what I mean. It's like, if aliens were making a movie about a gang warfare football event happening in England, this is probably what aliens would make, because they would read a book or maybe even watch Green Street and they think that this is reality and this is what they would present back. Like, I wonder how many English people were actually on this crew, with the exception of the actors who seem to turn up in all of these movies.
I'd say not too many. So ratings out of 10, Will, or ratings out of 100 on Rotten Tomatoes, it has 47%. 7.5 stars out of 10 on IMDb, which is pretty good. We've been averaging around about 6 to 8 in our last 5 movies. Lowest has been 4.5. So where are you putting this?
Yeah, so basically what seems to happen on this end, because I had a quick look this morning as well to see where this was rated, because for me, this is probably like, for cringe factor and for like bad movie, and this is what happens when you watch a movie like The Room, it's like, critically, I would put it way down like a 2 or a 3, but for just entertainment value and some of the scenes in it, I'd probably put it around a 7 or an 8, and that's kind of where I would stand. But it's funny, this movie appears to have been really well received in America, and I'm presuming that's probably largely why we have that final scene with Elijah Wood and him singing the bubble song as he comes out of a restaurant in Boston. Like, Roger Ebert gave this movie 3 stars out of 4. He's been known to give, like, you know, best pictures 2 out of 4. He's usually quite a tough critic to actually please, but he seemed to really like this. And the consensus among the American critics seemed to be that they were really entertained. So maybe we're just the wrong target market for this when it comes to critical acclaim. I think as a movie, probably about a 3. But if you want to be entertained, I reckon about a 7.
Wow. So where are you putting it?
I think maybe split the difference and call it a 5 then.
That's 3. That's awful. Well, to be fair, if you're going on critical...
The movie is awful, but that's why we enjoy it.
Yeah, to be fair, I'm putting this in the brackets of the Fast and Furious franchise and those sort of movies where you hate yourself for loving them, but you love them nonetheless. And do you know what? I'm giving this a 7.5 out of 10 because I loved watching this film as a youngster. I thought it was silly throughout and I love it even more. I watched it again before we did this and I'm probably going to watch it again soon enough. It's one of those movies that I can sit down and watch at any point in time.
Yeah, look, again, as I said at the very outset, I enjoyed sitting down to watch it this morning, and it absolutely flew by. I actually, for some reason in my mind, I thought the film was a little bit longer, and at one point I took a pause to go get a coffee, and I realised we're an hour in and the movie was nearly over. I was like, oh wow, this is just absolutely breezed by. So the message here, listeners, to Team 33 is that End of Call is not the man to watch an art house movie at Cannes, but he'll very happily watch Green Street 5 times, and I'm more than happy to endorse that as well.
Listen, anybody who knows me knows that I'm not a man that sits down and watches a 3-hour movie. I will happily sit and watch Adam Sandler movies and Owen Wilson movies back to back, no problem, no questions asked. But that is Green Street, or Green Street Hooligans if you're listening in the US. Will O'Callaghan, thanks very much for joining me.
Thanks, and enjoyed it.
We'll take a quick break. Connor Clancy is up after the break.
All right, so welcome back to Team 33. So the last time I spoke to Connor Clancy, his beard was slightly longer, his hair was slightly longer, and he hadn't been outdoors in about 2 weeks. That has all changed, and Italy is sort of back to normal. They're back to the Serie A as well. Connor, welcome to the show again. How are you getting on?
A lot better than I was the last time we spoke. Slightly longer. At the time we spoke, it got incredibly longer by the time I eventually shaved it off. So, yeah, I feel fresher, a lot happier as well.
Yeah, so we spoke, you had a longer set of hair. There's no football for a couple of weeks. You were stuck in the house. What have the last couple of weeks been like finally getting back to some sort of normality in Italy? Because in Europe, Italy was probably the worst hit country, and it took a while for them to get back going, but now they seem to be almost more open than Ireland are.
Yeah, well, even if you compare it to Ireland, on the face of it, it looks like it was much worse hit. But then when you look at the cases per million, it's actually not too different. It was more dramatically hit, for sure, because it was the first country in Europe to experience this virus. And then you had the fact that Italy has, I think it's the second oldest population in the world as well, behind China. So naturally, the figures of deaths were a lot higher than everywhere else. But the last few weeks have been, honestly, quite overwhelming, to be honest. I remember when we first got back outside, it was initially on the 4th of May, we were let outside to exercise and to take a walk or whatever. And I was still quite hesitant to be around crowds of people at the time because there were still quite a few new cases occurring every day. So I used to just go out for a walk at nighttime for a week or two. And then the cases just kept reducing and reducing. And then we got let back into bars on the 18th. And since then, it's just every day it seems more normal. Every day becomes more part of your routine to go outside, to go to a supermarket without having to be looking over your shoulder in case anyone comes too close. Most people are wearing masks. The number of people wearing masks is actually reducing in the last few days, which is a bit worrying. You think people might be getting a bit complacent with it, but in general, it's been amazing, a little bit emotional, a little bit overwhelming at times to be back outside and to be living in Italy again, basically.
Yeah, I suppose Italy was ahead of Ireland, which might play into it, but well, the scenes that you're sort of describing there of sort of looking over your shoulder, I suppose that's kind of where we're at the minute. I still, like, they're opening up the pubs now are open, you're allowed to go get a haircut. But going back to work, I still find myself sort of taking an extra step back if someone's walking towards me in the corridor. Is that something that you've found you've gotten to, or is that something that you're doing more? How has it been getting back into those kind of normal social interactions for you?
At the beginning, it's quite difficult, to be honest. You do have to have a constant awareness when you're outside, even if you're just walking down the street and you see someone maybe 20 meters ahead of you coming the same direction. You've got to make the decision, okay, I need to cross the street to the other side. Or in Italy, it's quite normal to just walk out into the street. So it's fine. I could walk along the street, staying 2 meters away from the person coming towards me before going back onto the path. But then that just becomes second nature, and you don't necessarily need to think about avoiding these people. You just naturally do it. If you see someone coming towards you, you just drift away, and it's not necessarily something that requires conscious thought. But yeah, at the beginning, it's quite strange because you are constantly on edge, trying to keep your distance from people. But then it does, I suppose, like anything, it's a bit like muscle memory now. I don't find myself thinking about doing it. I just notice myself doing it. There are some people, obviously, and there always were some people who weren't behaving in the same way. which is unfortunate. There was one guy who I was walking through the square in Parma, and he was smoking a cigarette, and he was like kept just drifting towards me, and I drift away, and then he drifted towards me, and I was drifting away, and I could smell the cigarette smoke. So I was thinking, right, everything you're exhaling, I'm inhaling, and I'm not happy with this. And then he wasn't wearing a mask or anything either, obviously. So I had to say, can you please just go away from me? I'm trying to walk away from you here. And then he kind of said, oh, okay, fair enough, sorry. So most people, even if they're not respecting the rules, they respect that you are respecting the rules. So they're okay about it if you kind of flag it up to them.
And has there been a sort of a divide between the older population and the younger population? Because I know here there are a lot of younger people, especially around the 21, 19 age group, that are sort of getting complacent. There, you see more groups meeting off for the down by the canal and stuff like that. Has there been an obvious divide like that in Italy as well, or what's it been like?
Yeah, kind of. The first time I really noticed the age difference thing was one of the first weekends that the bars were reopened. I went to, there's a local green area where me and my friends usually go and have a drink outside. And we were sitting down there, and there was a group of young people, probably between 18 and 21. And they met up, and one of them just clearly had no regard for anything. And she was trying to hug and kiss everyone that she greeted. And most of them responded. And it was only that one of her friends arrived wearing a mask. And when she went to embrace her, she was like, no, come on, don't be stupid. There's a virus. It's not finished. And then she kind of thought, oh, okay. And that was the first time where I noticed a younger person actually say, no, what you're doing is ridiculous. And it was to her friend. So it was quite encouraging. But generally speaking, yeah, the older people are taking more measures. They are being a little bit more reserved than the younger people are. Throwing caution to the wind that little bit more, which I suppose it's something you would expect, right?
Yeah, exactly. And it's kind of the same here as well. So, as I said, football is back across Europe. The Bundesliga is done and dusted. Bayern Munich are the champions. The Serie A is back. La Liga is back. And the Premier League is back as well. Before we get into the actual action on the pitch, one thing I wanted to ask you about was the attitude of the ultras in each club when it came to this sort of virus. There was a lot of discussion before this about Liverpool winning the league. Would their fans meet up outside the stadium to celebrate it? And I know that a lot of these clubs have right-wing fan bases. And if anything, if evidence shows you anything across the world, what right-wing people think of this virus is that it doesn't matter. It's not going to hurt them. And it's sort of a government ploy to take away your rights. So what have the ultra has been saying about this? What has their attitude been towards not being allowed back into the stadium?
Well, it's not even, it's the right wing thing. There are a couple of clubs who have right wing tendencies, particularly LS Verona will be one. Lazio have a section of their ultras group who are quite right wing, but generally speaking, they're extreme in their fandom, but not necessarily their political views. And the overriding thing here has been that the ultras are fully aware that the virus is a thing. When you see the numbers that Italy has experienced, it's hard not to. Everyone has been quite emotionally impacted by the number of deaths that we've seen here. Even people who don't necessarily know someone who has died from the virus. And the ultras' big complaint here is that the football has actually returned. So they are, and most of the clubs, I think all of the clubs in Italy, they signed a petition, the ultras, that is, before football returned, to say we don't want football coming back.
And is that because they can't go to the games?
Yeah, exactly that. They're basically going along with this whole thing that football without fans is nothing, right? Which I'm quite torn on, right? Because it's obviously a very, very different thing. But if football doesn't return, it may never return, because football clubs need the income that they generate from playing football matches to continue to exist. And even now, you've seen them in Bergamo Atalanta, which was the hardest hit city in Italy. Their fans are still putting banners up outside the stadiums when there are games on, saying, shame on you for playing. Shame on you to Lega Serie A, not to Atalanta necessarily. But yeah, the ultras groups aren't quite on board with the idea. But this is something that I was quite intrigued by. And I went out and I met a few Parma fans who are in the Curva every weekend with season ticket holders. And I just wanted to get their idea on things, because I mean, I saw this global protest against football returning, so I wanted to know what it was like in the city that I'm actually living in. Most of them I spoke to were kind of saying, look, it's not football, but at the end of the day, we are fans. So at the end of the day, we want Parma to win, whether we're there or not. We'll still watch the games. We'll still follow our usual routines of getting our scarves out and wearing our lucky shirts. And I think generally speaking, in Parma anyway, the mood has shifted from complete reluctance to reluctant support of the team nonetheless. And I'm not sure how that compares to other cities. In Bergamo, it seems that that's not quite the case. But yeah, they're back and most people seem to be accepting it.
Yeah, and I suppose it's like anything. Once you get used to it, then it sort of becomes a normality. And that's sort of what has happened with the Bundesliga and the Premier League. I think people got eased into it with European football returning first and got what it's going to look like. So the Premier League has definitely been a boost for people's morale in terms of just having something live to watch that means something. So the Serie A definitely does mean something to a lot of people. And there is a genuine the top four this year, which is quite interesting. Lazio are up there for the first time in a good while. So they're probably one of the clubs that I want to focus on. Simone Inzaghi took them over a couple of years ago. He was the assistant under Marcelo Bielsa. What's he brought to the team that they didn't have before? Because it has been a while since Lazio have found themselves in this position.
He's just brought this incredible unity, and the job he's done with Lazio isn't completely incomparable to what Gasperini has done with Atalanta. He's just raised the average players in the team. They've all stepped up a level, and the big players have just found a consistency that they never really had before. Like, sure, Immobile has become a complete goal machine, despite not being that traditional number nine who just operates in the box. He does everything for them. And then he's developed this like frightening partnership with Luis Alberto, who just assists him seemingly in every single match. And then they've just got a really good spine too. So Strakosha in goal, Acerbi at the back, Luis Alberto and Milinkovic-Savic in midfield, and Immobile up front. After that, there's not all that much quality in the team, but they just operate in a system that they play this 3-5-2 where Milinkovic-Savic and Luis Alberto in midfield have a bit more license to roam. The rest of their players, be it Marco Parolo or whoever plays in midfield, is much more limited to help with the defensive duties. And then the wing-backs are probably the weakest part of the team, but they bomb up and down. Manuel Lazzari, actually, who plays on the right, arrived from Spal last summer, and he's been one of the signings of the season in Serie A. Okay. He's just been completely incredible. But when he's been injured or whatever, it's quite obvious that they're lacking something on the right. And then, I mean, on the left, they've got Johnny at the moment, who's a complete disaster. It's kind of a mystery that a team are challenging for the Scudetto with him in the team. But no, Inzaghi's just raised the general level of everybody there and got the likes of Immobile and Alberto finding a consistency that a lot of people never really thought they could achieve. We saw Immobile with Sevilla, Borussia Dortmund, even when he was with Torino in that second spell, he wasn't always delivering. Luis Alberto, Liverpool fans will know him, right? Nobody could have foreseen he would go on to do what he's doing now. He's an absolute joy to watch. I think he's already in double figures for assists this season. The majority of those were probably for Immobile. And yeah, it's just Inzaghi's waved the magic wand and everything's clicking at Lazio.
Yeah, so he was actually the man who brought the likes of Ciro Immobile there and Luis Alberto as well. So he clearly has an eye for a player. Do Lazio have the spending power if they do finish second to compete in the top four for a couple of years? No?
No, absolutely not. The only club with spending power in Italy are really Juventus, and they don't spend all that often. I know they've just spent a crazy amount to sign Arthur Melo from Barcelona, but the fact that Pjanic has gone in the opposite way, the initial sum isn't exactly what it seems. And Juve just get free transfers in.
Yeah.
Clubs in Italy don't spend the same way that others do.
Yeah, well, that's an interesting one. And Juventus were actually in my next protocol. So they're probably going to win the league again this year. That's going to be Sarri's first trophy as a manager. What has he been like at Juventus? I know he's kind of brought a little bit of Sarri ball. It took a little bit of time for him to actually implement that. Have Juventus fans taken to him now that they're actually on the where they belong, or how's he been taken at Juventus?
He's leaving a lot to be desired at the moment. You know, when we think about Maurizio Sarri, particularly in Italy, where we saw the best of his football with Napoli and Empoli before that, you expect to see this like free-flowing attacking football, 1-2 touch passing that's just completely hypnotizing. It never really happened at Chelsea, but he was just given 1 year. But then when he returned to Italy, it was expected that that would just return, right? The last thing we saw of Sarri was incredible. So Sarri's going to return to Italy and be incredible again. And it's not been the case. Miralem Pjanic is someone who should have been really, really important to Maurizio Sarri's Juventus. And it just hasn't worked. He just hasn't hit the level of performance that he should have hit. Arthur Melo might well do that, but Rodrigo Bentancur has been by far the best midfielder at Juventus under Sarri, quite a promising Uruguayan player. And then Paulo Dybala, who everybody thought was made for this Sarri team. Juve did everything they possibly could to sell him last summer. They couldn't. He stayed, and he's been their most important player this season. I think if they lost Dybala, they wouldn't be winning Serie A this season. Cristiano Ronaldo doesn't really matter. He scores a lot of goals, but I mean, they won Serie A, what, seven times in a row before he arrived. They would have done it without him last year. They probably would do it without him this year as well. Dybala's the real one. So if it wasn't for Paulo Dybala, I think Maurizio Sarri would be in a lot more trouble than he currently is.
Right, and chances of Champions League, are they the dominant force that they could somehow find them their way to the final? I know they have Lyon, so that's almost a given that they should beat them. Are they good enough to go to the Champions League final this year? From what I've seen with Juventus, it's really sort of stop-start. And like you said, the Sarri ball hasn't really take and fold the same way as it had at Napoli. So do they have enough strength with Alexis or not? De Ligt in defence. I know Chiellini has signed a new contract as well. So obviously he must have some sort of favour with the players.
It's hard to write off a team like Juventus, but I've not seen one single performance from them this season that suggests they're good enough to win the Champions League. But this is what Juve do every single year. They make it to March. And I suppose it's kind of March now in football calendar terms. They make it to March without having really done anything. And then they just click into gear. The Champions League nights start coming and they deliver. They've gotten to two finals in recent years just because they know what to do. That they've not got that back three of Barzagli, Chiellini and Bonucci anymore, but De Ligt is starting to find his feet at last. Chiellini is returning from injury. He'll be fine by the time August comes around for the Champions League. And it's hard to write them off just because they've got Cristiano Ronaldo and they've got players with the know-how to make it through these one-off games. But honestly, I don't think they have a chance. And if they win the Champions League, it's probably going to be one of the most undeserving Champions League winners in recent years, because it's debatable that they've even been the best team in Italy this year. Like before the break, I would have backed Lazio to win the Scudetto every single time I was asked. The break came at an unfortunate time for them and they lost their first game back after the break. So Juve are now favourites. But no, I really, really, really do not think that Juve have any chance of winning the Champions League. Even in terms of Italy's representatives, Atalanta and Napoli are teams that I would back to go further, because Atalanta just score a ridiculous amount of goals and Napoli have been quite resurgent under Gennaro Gattuso as well, and they beat Juve in the Coppa Italia final.
Yeah,
it went to penalties, but Napoli were by far the better team. But Juve in Europe, I'm not so sure.
So in terms of the best of the rest, then you mentioned Napoli and Atalanta, the likes of Roma, are they all at a similar level, or who do you fancy to be in those Champions League spots come to the end of the season?
I think it will finish as is. I think the top four will be Juve, Lazio, Inter and Atalanta in that order, probably. I wouldn't be too surprised if Inter fell away and Atalanta even finished third again, well, as they did, I think, 4 years ago. It wouldn't be too surprising. But Roma are two hit and miss. There's now a 9-point gap for them to recover on Atalanta. Napoli just left it too late. I mean, they were around 13th, 14th at Christmas. So it was always going to be difficult. They're 12 points off the Champions League. They play Atalanta this evening, which could make things a little bit interesting. But even that, it's a 9-point gap to overturn if they beat Atalanta this evening. And it does seem like the top four is going to stay as is. And I think that's probably fair. These four teams have been by far the four best teams in Italy this season. No real question about it. And it's been reflected in Europe as well. Not with Inter, but with Juve and Atalanta getting to the stages they're at, I suppose it's probably fair enough.
And before I let you go, Connor, there are a couple of stories I just want to finish up on. So obviously the contracts have been something that has tickled some people's fancies over here when it comes to the likes of Jeff Hendrick, who is apparently going to a Serie A club. Firstly, are you hearing anything of AC Milan signing up Jeff Hendrick? Are there other clubs in Italy that are interested in him? How likely is that transfer?
I heard about it through British press, like most people did. I was surprised by it at first, but I think Hendrick's actually a player who he wouldn't necessarily do too badly in Italian football. He's technically quite good, and he likes a bit of physicality. He'd probably slot into a few midfields quite nicely. People obviously laughed at that link, right? Because it's Jeff Hendrick going to Milan. But I think that's people thinking about Milan as the name rather than Milan in their current standing. They're seventh in Serie A. They're doing well to be ahead of Hellas Verona, Cagliari and Parma at the moment. So that's the level that Milan are currently at. As unfortunate as it is to say, I know they've got Zlatan Ibrahimovic, so people think differently. But yeah, Milan and Jeff Hendrick would probably be quite a nice fit. Although if I was Jeff Hendrick, I'd probably go to any Serie A club other than Milan, because it's not really geared up to succeed for anyone arriving at Milan, unfortunately.
And the other English clubs, or other English players playing in Italy, the likes of Chris Smalling, Alexis Sanchez as well, they extended their contract at the end of the year. Are they likely to stay on post that? I know Smalling has been welcomed quite well in Roma, but not so much with Alexis Sanchez.
Smalling started incredibly well. He's kind of, I don't want to say regressed to the mean, because that seems a little bit harsh, but his performances have definitely dipped since Christmas. I spoke to him here in Parma in November, and he was loving it. He was absolutely loving his time in Italy, and I kind of pushed him to see if he was going to try to stick around. And although he didn't commit to an answer, the way he spoke definitely suggested he would be happy to stick around in Roma for another year or whatever it may be. He's definitely a player that Roma could do with keeping around as well. Alexis Sanchez, again, he was very unfortunate. He started quite well, had a bit of promise, and then there was a game at Sampdoria where he was the best player on the pitch. I think he scored twice and then got sent off. And then that kind of just summed up his time at Inter. He never really hit those heights. He impressed when he came on here at Parma the other night, but I mean, he was always going to in those situations, I suppose. And Victor Moses, Ashley Young as well, other players who initially did okay in their first few games, since the restart haven't been quite as impressive. But Moses got the assist for Inter's winner in the last minute at Parma the other day, and Ashley Young had a hand in the other goal. He delivered the corner. So I don't think they're complete disasters. Whether or not they can continue to show some sort of level remains to be seen. But it's not like they've come in as Premier League rejects and torn the league apart. But it's not as if they've come in and completely flopped either. They're somewhere in between.
All right, Connor, good stuff. Hopefully the next time we're talking to you, there hasn't been another second wave and your hair stays the perfectly hairdressed haircut that you have right now for the next couple of weeks. Connor Clancy, thanks very much.
Cheers, Andy.
Now, welcome back to Team 33. That is about all we have time for on tonight's show. My thanks to you for listening. If you want to listen back to any of that show, you can find us as part of the OTB Podcast Network on the brand new OTB Sports app, available now in the App Store or Google Play Store to download. It's great. Give it 5 stars if you like it, or if not, let us know what we could change about it. You can see that on YouTube as well, youtube.com/offtheball. We'll be back again same time, same place, but until then, take away, Johan. Hoy, 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 a passare la noi, e vos credo.
That was an OTB Podcast Network presentation.